Have another open discussion this evening with Ismail. Ismail, a few people have said, will you speak as slowly as possible? For some reason, they don't like your German accent. So, as he said at the mic tonight, if you don't understand, raise your hand
please,
and you'll repeat.
Please, yes.
So, that will work out.
You have to remember that people in the Caribbean, the way we train ourselves in philosophy is we speak over each other constantly. And it is the way we communicate. And for many people, that's a very aggressive and violent way of communicating. But for us, it's the way we communicate. So, you know, we use our hands a lot, and somebody starts, and before they finish, somebody jumps in. And it's not that manners, it's just a different way of doing it.
All right.
So it's difficult for me to digress myself, but that's part of my personality.
We jump in around the world.
Thank you.
All right. Anyone want to start the discussion this evening?
Let me say something else, not really to be right wrong. I really will benefit tremendously with the you discuss with each other as well.
Okay.
I mean, I will benefit a tremendous deal of it. If a part of the conversation is not this way on the if that's the preference, I don't know.
Could I ask you to start with something?
Sure.
You were giving us an analysis of the two LCA documents we were reading. Could you repeat in as short a form as possible what your basic criticisms were, or your basic fundamental criticisms were? Of those documents. I thought they were rather good.
Let me read to you a quotation of them. Listen to this. Justice takes place at the intersection of serving love and enlightened self-interest. Now that's not clear to me what it means, and the document doesn't bother to explain it. So that's an in-house term. All sinners, including Christians, are still able, as the corrupted image of God, to act justly out of such self-regard. And forgiving Christians are empowered to move beyond such self-regard. By the power of Christ working in them, they are free to enlarge the conventional limits of God. I think basically my critique is the poor would never express that in that way, because it will paralyze the possibility of engaging in political activity. Self-interest is why you act politically. Whose interests are they going to defend? It reveals who writes the document, the bias of the document. It reveals the lack of urgency to justice question. The more reflective.
Okay, because you hear that it implies an equal critique of the poor and those in power, is that it? I mean, it says both are sinful, hence...
Both are self-interest. Therefore, their justice really is corrupt.
They're equally under God's judgment. And that way, the poor who will really have a reason for self-interest, you would say, don't get a fair shake in that kind of
That's argument. One thing, and they also argue that their particular assertion of self-interest, in principle, does not violate the whole.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a difficult one to deal with. But that's, you know, the blacks will argue. Our wanting to have racial identity is not racism against the whites. It's just a necessary step in our formation as a people. And are pushing our interests from that perspective, we need that space to be among ourselves, asserting our self-interest.
I think that the problem in those two terms, sacrificial love and enlightened self-interest, as they're talking about that intersection, is that we tend always to talk about sacrificial love as individual action, and thus the the negation of that in, by self-interest is also seen as that individualistic selfishness. There is no understanding, it seems to me, or not an enlarged understanding of seeing that self-interest as being corporate and corporately expressed. Nor, on the other hand, seeing sacrificial love as a corporate expression. You know, that it's the, as you said, the sum of the individual. And that's why it gets it muddled in there.
Yeah. Let me ask you something. Are you married?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you love your wife?
Yeah.
Do you expect her to love you in return for the love you give her? Now, be honest about that.
Yeah, I do.
You do expect mutuality, don't you?
Yeah.
The church doesn't speak too much about that.
I think it's because they see self-interest as only individual and never, because in self-interest corporately is mutuality, isn't it?
Basically speaking, it's essential for the preservation and nourishing of relationships.
I wonder how much that kind of thinking that's reflected in that document, that whole emphasis on self-sacrifice, has also stemmed from the theology of the cross. I once heard a lecture on why the theology of the cross was not good news to women. And I think a lot of that applies to why that is not good news to the poor.
I mean, you know, the case of women, I mean, women know what sacrificial love is. Mm-hmm. They don't have to be asked to keep on doing it. They know what that is. I understood, the first time I understood the concept of sacrificial love when my daughter was born. She used to sleep 4 hours a day. And the other 20, she was crying all the time. She was healthy, and according to the doctor, happy. Listen, I understood why certain people throw their children out the window. I understood what it meant to be, to have lockdown fever, locked in a Chicago winter, with 14 feet of snow out there, with my wife in that apartment and that kid crying day in and day out. I understood a little bit what self-sacrificial love is. I offer neutrality. I can offer neutrality. Now, the theologically speaking, does the emphasis on sacrificial love violate the Trinity? It makes Christ so overpresent in the midst of our church that we lose the sense of parenthood and Holy Spirit. But when you look at the three figures, there is a mutuality in them. And I think this notion of mutuality has tremendous political implications, has tremendous theological implications. It's actually the way we go about establishing relationships. But theologically, sometimes we don't account for that.
But can't sacrificial love be mutual? Can't my wife love me sacrificially and I love her sacrificially?
That's a very important point. You know, there's so much irony in the human condition that the young person like myself tries to understand it. I always believe that ethics is the science for all people. Because they lived enough to know what actually might be good and might be bad. So I feel a little bit out of place trying to... But you know, there is a sense in which somebody has to sacrifice for the whole thing to be going. And there is a legitimate sense in which you have to politically say to the poor, you still have to sacrifice a little bit more if we're going to keep this together. There's a sense of that. And it's an irony, isn't it? That we have to tell the weakest part, still we have to give in more. There might be some, humanly politically speaking, there might be some truth to that. There might be some truth.
I think one of the things that the language of using mutuality is there comes a hint, a very strong hint, of conditionality with that. as if it would, if you love me, I will love you. Mutuality as an entity is it conditional? When does the seed of hope of mutuality begin without a conditional? And how does the process then fit in with mutuality?
Well, that's interesting. See, I hope you're wrong, because then I will have a stronger case. But, you know, mutuality, in my understanding, and I think in the biblical understanding, I think it's a strong form of understanding agape. And self-sacrificial is not the only way. It's not really a contract in which I'll give if you give and we will be more or less sure that we give equal. It's more covenantal. That is, I will give and I'm expecting you to return. And I will see to it that you become aware that I need your return. We need the love of our spouses. We can't always be given. Teachers need the refreshment of the new challenge at the end from students and their colleagues. They cannot only be giving. Ministers need the pastoral care of the congregation and their colleagues. And I don't think that's strictly a contract. I hope it doesn't lose itself to that. The more covenantal relationship. And the struggle is, I'll stand here and I expect you to respond. I expect you to respond, and I'll make you aware of that. But what happens if you say no?
Then do you become a sacrifice to what you believe in?
If for the sake of mutuality, is there a place for that? I think, yeah. I think, yeah, and usually it's the weakest part. Mm-hmm. Usually it is the weakest part. It's an irony of history. Usually it is the equal part. In liberation theology, the liberation of the oppressed is made by the oppressor. Ultimately. Because you never are liberated without the other.
And the weakest part then is the strongest.
Sometimes, we hope.
Can you have this theology of mutuality if you're, how you picture your faith is a hierarchical one? Which I think in Lutheran theology is, which I think, because as if mutuality is one where we need one another and we have expectations around one another, we can maybe get to that place within the human community, but where I think in Lutheran doctrine we have problems is having that same kind of expectation between us and God. And so I think that may be creating some problems with our understanding a theology of mutuality, because we're trying to fit it into a hierarchical relationship between God and people.
My bias is that when you have a clear hierarchical relationship, you can only have mutuality if the one in power defines it, limits it, and establishes it. But when the one in power sees the lower party demanding it, claiming for it, the attitude is defensiveness. The attitude is resistance. The attitude is holding on to things I think I will lose of your affections in the living world. And it's difficult. It is much more difficult. Mutuality demands, I think, a recognition of some basic equality among us, in spite of all the other inequalities we have. And it demands a wanting to get near the other. As a race of theology, one of the things, the enactment against the wealthy, I think it's very biblical. I think one of the problems with the wealthy is that they become a little bit too self-secure. They lose their sense of dependence. And there is a sense in which when you use the sense of dependence with people around you, you have a distorted sense of dependence on God. You can't have that fundamental experience. Another way of saying it, you also lose your capacity of coming out of yourself and reaching for someone else. And if you lose that, it's difficult to understand God as that being that actually graciously comes out of self to be for someone else, even when they don't deserve it, especially when they don't deserve it. I'm trying to say that when you lose these anthropological elements, you miss elements of revelation, aspects of being known by God. Maybe.
Earlier you compared mutuality to covenant. Is that a word that's also used in liberation theology? Going back to what Sonia said, I think we have a hard time with the Old Testament because we tend to read it conditionally, or the language comes across in a very conditional way. And maybe that's because we don't have an understanding of covenant.
But I think in liberation theology, you find a lot of covenants, especially when there is disagreement among the communities that are struggling for liberation. In which there is a sense in which the solidarity is kept in spite of particular differences. So therefore, our relationship is not based on the specificity of certain things. It is broader than that. It covers the wholeness of the relationship. And to that we have a strict commitment. Even though sometimes we fail in this thing or we do it differently here or there. But I think the word covenant reflects my Calvinist bias. I'm gradually opting for Calvin over Luther, more and more. And I think the bias is basically because of the passion Calvinism has for political reform. That is something that somehow speaks theologically to me and to the people I live with. So, I put that bias in the table. It's an easy term among the Calvinists.
We'll help you with that.
I would venture to guess that some sociologists would claim that there is no self-sacrificing love at all, that everything is done because of self-interest. Let us say that a person like Mother Teresa, she suffers so much because of the poor in India that in order to alleviate her own pain, she goes and takes care of these people. Now, I, as a pastor in my congregation, I have very obnoxious members there at the altar. I'm nice to these people because if I'm in bad terms with these guys, the council would not agree to my pay raise. So I have self-interest in being nice with people. I'm not doing it because I'm a nice guy, even though I might also be bad, but that's not the motivator. I don't know if there's anything a human person does without some self-interest. I don't know if a mother even takes care of a child because she's so absolutely self-sacrificing. Isn't it because she wanted the baby, or there is some kind of instinct to take care of your offspring? I was wondering if there was any way this kind of self-interest could be made so largely known that if you help the poor people of the earth, they might be able to buy your stuff and you get richer.
Well, you have a couple of things in there. One of them is, anthropologically speaking and psychologically speaking, nobody has been able to prove that altruism is not a legitimate part of human experience. I mean, nobody has been able to prove that. And I think our daily experience shows that certain people give of themselves for very little in return. And that they do it sometimes not for the results they get, but for the pleasure of the activity being done. I'll give you a might be an awful example, but it might help to make the point I want to. My grandfather was a fisherman. And he fished to make a living. So once in a while, he used to wake me up at 3 o'clock in the morning, put me in a little boat with rowing, to go in waves that were 20 feet higher than the boat, scare the hell out of me. But we used to do that, and the idea was be there at 3 o'clock, get all the fish together by 5:30, come in at 6, go to the market and get the best price. But then he went fishing on weekends. And there, it was different. Because there the thing was, he had a very unique, fishing rod? Very unique fishing rod, with a very funny fishing thing. I don't know much about fishing in spite of all this experience. But very unique thing, to catch a particular fish with a name in the middle of an ocean, beyond me, he knows his name is there. And it made no difference whether he caught the fish or didn't, he enjoyed it. And I think Christians are neither better nor worse than people that sometimes do things because they enjoy it.
They give it. You're doing it because of your own self-pleasure.
You might not get the pleasure.
Well, I don't know anybody who enjoys something without
You might not get it. I mean, the pleasure would have been really nice if we caught the fish.
No.
You might not get it.
Pleasure's in the fishing. The pleasure's in the fishing.
The pleasure is in the fish, but it will be an extra reward if you get it.
Right.
So basically, the self-interest, who could not be?
That's a lousy example, I think.
It could not be. If you have the self-interest of getting the fish, you will use the net to use to get it. But basically, what I'm trying to say to you is sometimes we do things because doing them themselves is their own reward, whether or not we achieve the end we wanted. You might take a friend to see a mountain today. Really wanting
to
get
myself.
Yourself. Always.
And I want to share the pleasure that he gets out of.
Haven't you ever taken a family 20 times to the Sears Tower when you don't want to go?
No, I always wanted to go.
Well, then, you are very selfish. I could just feel having done things that really were not timely, I didn't enjoy it, but somehow I felt that it was a thing to do because it was really
But you still
have
so.
It sounds like a blessing, but.
But because you enjoy the fact that other people get pleasure, right? And as far as you think that the other people's pleasure is somehow above your own suffering, you still do it.
But what happens if they don't get the pleasure?
Then you don't do it.
No, you did it.
See,
that's the issue. You can't control that result.
Then you end it.
I hear
a real good Lutheran behind you, Ismael.
Yeah.
He's looking for perfection in himself.
Oh, yeah.
And unless he has perfection himself, he can't call anything good. It seems to me it's so often our problem, and maybe it is our narrow understanding of sin or something.
Let me ask something to Lutheran.
We can't really be a good Christian unless our motives are totally pure. We can't really act unless we are all out.
Let me ask you a question, because I think it's a very important issue. Do you care about increasing the good?
Of what?
Of course. Whatever good.
In general, the good. Is that an issue? I mean, is your ethics one that values increasing the good, or is it an ethics that emphasizes not doing evil?
That's both.
The difference. I mean, political speaking, the classical doctrine is. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Take a straw vote on the Lutherans here.
Yeah.
How many would say for the good? Great teacher.
What motivates you is to increase the good, even though you might be supporting righteousness, or is your motive more to prevent evil? And there is a difference. Huh?
What's the difference?
Well, I'll talk to you later.
The doing good might be the preventing of evil, I think.
And separate
the two. Well, let me give you an example. I might not be under an obligation to jump into a swimming pool to save a little child because I don't know how to swim, and so on and so forth, and I won't do that good, right? But I'm under strict obligation not to throw the kid in. Okay? Not doing the good is fairly well defined. It's something we can control. We have understanding of it, generally speaking. Always doing the good has this problem that you just get tired of doing it. Because there's always so much good to do. Okay? Politically speaking, which is why I'm interested in, the Calvinist tradition has said that the purpose of the state ultimately is to promote the good life. The Lutheran tradition has argued the purpose of the state is really to restrain people. But it's interesting to see if modern Lutherans struggle with that, or do they recognize the difference in that?
But that's not what Peter says. Peter says that the object of government is to reward the good and to restrain the evil, to do both. Mm-hmm. And my understanding of agape is not that you're always looking for some return. God doesn't say to me, I'll love you if you love me in return. Mm-hmm. The very character of agape is to love when you expect no return. That's why in the gospel lesson not a couple Sundays ago, Jesus says, don't give a banquet for your friends and your relatives and so on. Give it to the poor and the maimed and the blind who can't repay you. Okay? That's what love is.
Do you think that's
but it's exactly what we don't do, ever.
Huh?
How many of us have...
Well, I'm not saying we can do it. That's perfection, but God does it, and God is love. God is a God.
Listen to your response to that. I already said.
No, 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 no.
You respond to him. I don't hear what you say there.
Yeah.
How do you interpret that?
Well, descriptively, for example, my experience has been when I give into the poor, I will receive a lot in return. Tremendous hospitality, tremendous self-giving, tremendous sense of appreciation. So that's descriptively. It's not clear to me that they don't have that to give. One of the most things they have to give is the warmth. It's a very powerful kind of giving. I always remember, I was in a survey of government, a census kind of thing. And when I used to go to the homes of the poor neighborhoods next to the university, everybody will invite me in to have coffee, and I don't drink coffee. By the time I finished the day, I had in me about 30-something cups of coffee. Because you wouldn't dare say no. Mm-hmm. Precisely because they hardly have coffee. But I hardly ever get invited inside when I visited a middle class house. Hardly ever. They treat me outside. What do you want? I'll answer this and I'll have to go. So that's one part, the descriptive part. Secondly, I think there's something to recognize that there are activities proper of God that are unique to God. And this never-ending capacity of giving, I think, is properly the divine attribute. Like is the capacity to create, and like is the capacity to constantly forgive. I'm not sure, humanly and politically speaking, we can sustain relationships like that.
No, that's probably true.
I'm not sure.
But the question is that what motivates you to try it? See, that's what love is. Love motivates you, even though you're not always going to get the return.
But I think that part of what motivates you is that many times you get the return. I mean, it's interesting. Economically speaking, we all buy into the incentive system. And when we think theologically, we take it out. So then we split our theological reflection from our daily activity. Seems to me, why should we? And anyhow, we begin to speak in a language that somehow, sometimes I don't know if we really believe in it. And I worry about the consequences of that.
We don't believe what? Which don't we believe?
Well, for example, this whole idea of self-sacrificial love. Is that is the basis under which we actually relate to one another. It has a place to it, I'm not denying that. But what, I mean, how does it provide a theological vision for the other ways we go about it? It's not clear to me.
My question is whether or not liberation theology, in terms of its practical applications and actual social policy and the things that it pushed for, are not a 20th century kind of enlightenment effort. The institutionalization of enlightenment institutions, schools and people, facilities and democracy, etc.
Oh yeah, I mean, that's a very powerful question. And I think the answer to that is yes and no. It is yes because we carry our history with us. I mean, the Enlightenment is part of who we are. And there are many positive things within it. So the denial of the Enlightenment is not the denial of its totality. It's the denial of its inhumanity. And we can't do that before the Enlightenment is in place. We discover those as we move along in our journey, as we were told this morning. And we try to carry out. I mean, liberation theology has, and how do you say the name? Cumulative. Certain words so difficult for the Spanish tongue. Cumulative understanding of history, in which you preserve certain things from your past, and you're good. And you're healthy. The vision of an enlightened person capable of managing your personal life. Nothing wrong with that. It's very important to spend so far the rationality of both, the suspicion it gave us. So is the pushing toward that. But then it becomes a matter of also of inclusiveness. Who are the people left out? Whose expression didn't have a place? Who didn't get the reward of what produced by society? And then you keep on pushing. You carry over. So the answer is liberation theologians have a cumulative understanding of history and a long-term understanding. This struggle is already defined. There yesterday, every definition of liberation carries within it the limits of its moment. And as we move along, people redefine this word. And there's nothing we can do about it. It's part of our finitude, not to say our sentence. In history, we journey. We open up and travel. So it's not a complete negation. You carry that, means you just cannot free yourself. I think liberation theologians take very seriously how determined we are by history. The limits we have in history, we take those very seriously.
I'm not sure I understood you correctly, but did I hear you say that in the Old Testament there was a proclamation of justice by the prophets, and in the New Testament there was a lack of proclamation.
Does the New Testament expert here? Let me ask you.
I'm glad you raised it because
yeah. I mean that's very powerful. Do you find that the New Testament has a social ethic?
Yes, I think
it's
it
social
is. I think it
yeah.
is the seed for a social
ethic. Well, come on.
I think it's more in seed form rather than in developed form.
That's a nice way of saying no,
well,
maybe.
No, but you made the statement that in your lecture that we can only speak of justice in terms of the prophets and not justice in terms of Jesus.
That was a description of my experience, but I would be interested.
Okay, but I think recent work in New Testament studies has almost said that's not so at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've recovered the social dimension in Jesus' teaching to a great deal. Jesus as the man for others. Jesus as the one who was on the side of the weak and the outcast and the poor and the dispossessed gave his whole ministry.
But that doesn't
that
give
direction.
You a social ethics. That gives you a communal ethics. That gives you an ethics for interrelationship between small communities. You see, this is basically the issue.
Well, wait, now, to be on the side of the dispossessed seems to me places you then, and if you identify with the dispossessed, then you're on the side of the social ethic. Because then what do you want to bring the dispossessed into a better situation of justice in the world?
It doesn't give you a social ethic. It gives you a warmth and personal ethics, but it doesn't give you a social ethic. See, what do we mean by social ethics today?
Yeah, define that.
Basically, see, what do we mean by social ethics today? We mean the restructuring, the basic restructuring of basic social institutions. Social ethics is concerned with the formation of basic social institutions.
Well, the prophets didn't have that in mind either.
They had, it seems to me, I hope that Campbell was here, he can argue this better than I am, when Jesus taught it. How can I put this? They have a critique of the social chaos that develops when land and certain basic means of production begin to be privately owned. And therefore they have a much more incipient social ethic than the New Testament, because they deal with the issue structurally. Now the issue, one of the points I was trying to make today is that we tend to move too fast between our modern understanding, which is heavily landed by the social sciences, to New Testament, which did not have that point of view when they dealt with issues. And part of the confusion we're having is assuming that personal virtues of justice are equated to the creation of social institutions. Now for us, when we speak of social justice, one of the first things that comes to mind is the welfare state, whether we're for it or against it. But it's one of the main things. What institution in society is going to do this? It's an interesting way, because the basic mechanism is how do we organize institutions so that in our selfishness we do the good we don't intend. I mean, that's basically the idea. But how do we do that institutionally because we can't rely on personal persuasion. Now, in the New Testament, I'm still persuaded, in spite of the fact that most liberation theologians are arguing like Walter's argument, in spite of the fact, I'm still persuaded that when you look for that social ethics there, you don't find it. You have a sense of communal, covenantal, interpersonal ways of how do we relate to one another, which is very powerful and very important, but does not make a social ethics.
Let me talk about my own experience. I'm involved in immigration issues. I've been involved in social justice and peace issues for a number of years, and I'm very much committed to changing social institutions. But I never was motivated by a system of social ethics, whether New Testament or anything else. What motivated me to do that? From my point, what I have seen in myself is, I think that's what Christ wants me to do.
That's a powerful simple faith. And it's there. I mean, I'm not going to deny that grounding. I mean, that's a powerful simple
well,
faith.
What it seems to me then is that my knowledge of Christ and what Christ teaches has become, in effect, without my knowing it, a kind of social ethic for me. Okay.
I won't argue.
But social ethics is not supposed to be the motivator, isn't it? Supposed to be the study of the institutions and the study of the good and bad and right and wrong with respect to these institutions.
The study of principles and mechanisms of justice,
right.
In a way. But it's interesting, you see, because you said something that is very powerful. There is a sense in which to take care of certain basic human needs, you don't need a theological justification for that. Although certain people might do it out of religious conviction. And that religious conviction sometimes. You know, Karl Barth didn't appreciate ethics too much. He had a suspicion about the whole thing. As opposed to other, Paul Ramsey, for example, that developed a whole ethical structure that's important to keep the tradition and so on and so forth, and so that people can teach their children, and we learn from our past, and their cumulative sense and so on and so forth. So the Christian tradition had built. Tomorrow, I will say explicitly, one of the problems with liberation theologians is that they don't have the social ethics. And they move very fast from theological claims into political options. Well, that's interesting. That's also dangerous. You see, the Exodus has a liberating image for them. It's a very oppressive image for the South Africans.
I have a problem with what you're saying. Because it seems to me you're asking for social ethics to come up with a system that will ensure justice. You're really looking for a structure that will be the right delivery system for justice.
Yes.
Is that so utopian? I mean, is that all too utopian?
Oh, I hope not, but I think it's sociologically sound in that the point...
We realize we have to critique capitalism, we have to critique...
Socialism, medieval society.
But now we're going to come up with a system that will be reasonably better than these?
Well, basically what you want to come out is with institutions that will mold the people within them in its image. That's what social ethics tries to do. Tries to mold behavior. And the basic idea is, if you're going to change the way people build their character, you're going to have to change the social institutions that shapes your character in a given way. Now, religiously speaking, that is very important. Because sometimes one of the assumptions of preaching is that if I tell them enough times, be good, they're going to do it. But sociologically and politically speaking, they tell you, no, if you want the blacks to come to your church and stay, you have to build within your church mechanisms of interrelationship that will provide dynamics between people that will lead them to find out how gracious it is to be with one another. You have to change those behaviors. You can't do that only by speaking. You have to structure the way your life is oriented. Now that's a sociological principle. And you have theories of social change that argue, no, change the individual first and they will change society. And others that argue, no, change society first and those will change the individual. The position I'm trying to expose is you have to go there, working at both ends. But the social ethics tries to do that.
What is the tie, then, between social ethics as you're defining it and thinking of it, and the gospel? What's the connection there?
Well, let me say something to see if I can, if I manage it. Let me give you a comparative mode. Muslims have within the Quran a very developed social and political ethic. And it's one of the reasons why I think, I might be wrong in this, that they have rejected Marxism as an option for them to organize their society. But they look within their sacred scripture and they find certain things that they claim work for them. The history of Christianity has been adaptation to a significantly different ways of organizing society and an appeal to philosophical, political principles and theories to organize their options. And they've done it with medieval society, with capitalism, and they're doing it with socialism, and they'll probably do it with something else. Because they have that vacuum within. Therefore, they need the appeal from without. However, and I think this is part of Walter's answer, and at that point I do agree with him, there is an ethos of things that are valued within the faith. There are traits of character of the Jesus movement that inform the way we go about thinking and discriminating between options. The Jesus movement, for example, was inclusive of rich and poor. And inclusiveness is the value for us as Christians. And the worst thing that can happen to our churches is when we don't have that inclusiveness. We should have socialists in our churches with capitalists in our churches discussing theologically why they make those political options. They should have the capacity to remain within the church to have that conversation. That is one of the major services the churches can give. We should have people with the different political ideologies and their economic options, so on, discussing them within the community of faith. Why is it that I see my faith making me up for this as opposed to that? And in conversation about this. When a church becomes a uniformity that everybody more or less belongs, the same class, with the same political bank, and this and that.
What about politics and religion? You're right away now then talking about politics and religion, which you're not supposed to do.
Let me ask if I gave her something of an answer. Because maybe I didn't.
Yeah.
But you see, I'm inclusive in one value because of that. Different people see the divinity differently, and we need one another to share those. And we live differently, and we need to explain one another what is the legitimacy of that. And the church has to provide the forum for that conversation. Internationally speaking today, for example, it is a conversation taking place within the churches that is making a tremendous difference for people that cannot trust themselves politically to be able to communicate. So that's another level, the diversity. There is a sense of, what? Of feeling welcome, feeling equal, being included. So some very powerful values that enable us to discriminate among institutions. Christians ought to be offended when they find an institution that is rather excluding. You find that there is that. Did I answer some of what?
That goes back to relationship then. It's because that I'm in relationship with you that I can be different from you and express those differences.
Yeah.
It's because of that connectedness.
One of the ministers today was telling me that he's had the experience of people that go to church but are not interested in community.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You lose your sense of peoplehood. You lose your sense of accountability, and it's not clear to me why you go to begin with. You can stay at home and watch it on TV. And it's not clear to me that religion doesn't become magic. I go there, something happens that some makes a difference somehow, but I keep on doing the same things I always do. I'm not interested in the ones I'm sitting with. That's a serious issue. Because community has been a basic Christian value. One sheep is lost, the community is not whole till we get it. You have to go and get it. It's important. For the homes of the community. The person who goes to church and not enters the community. I mean, what are the limits of this? What's going on?
That's not what we do with that story, though. We make that into that one sinner, you know, that somebody went out to get.
Well, we can do anything, but, you know, it depends what image and point you want to make.
We do it.
But But that's an issue, because one of these things is very important. And it is a relationship and it is an accountability.
And then that gets back into selfishness again, in that because we have raised up in our society as a great, if you can be independent, which is a total myth, but it was held up as wonderful. If you can be independent, independently whatever, and we put up the fences between yards, and that everybody has their washer and dryer, everybody has a dishwasher, everybody has a car. The individualism, independent, our whole language is it, which is leads into capitalism feeding on itself in order to destroy itself or something, but the one, it feeds the other. You want in capitalism in order to become more independent, in order to become more capitalistic, and in the long run, what is the life of capitalism within a given country? I don't know.
You know what exemplified that for me the best way? A little old white woman that by some accident of sorts fell into need and refused to go get well. And she was like, on one side there is pride and there's some type of admiration about that. It's material. And on the other side there's pain and you go, she won't let me and other people reach to her. And it's interesting, isn't it? It's internalized to such a point in which the fuel system, the indignant, is still the same. That is a gift, that's not a right. It's not justice that the poor get what they can't get by themselves. It's indignant. How does one deal with that?
I'm not sure. I want to take the discussion in a little different direction.
Your discussion?
You said you're more comfortable leaning toward a Calvinist understanding versus a Lutheran understanding. I'm kind of curious whether you see any threads or movements within Roman Catholicism to deal with the structure, to not just offer social service.
Calvinism. I mean, liberation theology is all Catholic. Well, very few sprinkles of Protestantism.
Okay.
The Methodist here, the Roman here.
I didn't hear you say that, and that was my understanding.
By history, by theology, Catholics have always had strong social ethics. Look, in a Catholic seminary, you are coerced into taking at least 3 or 4 courses in ethics. Moral theology and some other stuff. In a Reformed seminary, you're lucky if you get one. You're lucky if you get one. And sometimes it doesn't have to do much with anything.
I'd like to pick up on something a little bit before. We were talking Old and New Testament. As far as the concept of structure and communities. It seems to, and then you mentioned community a few minutes ago before we got on to the last topic. It seems to me that the New Testament is full of the concept of Christians in community. The whole concept of the kingdom of God is community. The concept of discipleship is community. The concepts of St. Paul, the Christians are one body and working together. It seems to me that lays the basis for not only individual ethics, but also communal ethics. And it seems to me that contradicts what you were saying, that there is not sufficient emphasis in the New Testament on justice, because if you have a community where there is equality, where there is commonality, then maybe that's what Walter was talking about. He said the seed of justice is in the New Testament.
I think it was Walter was talking about.
Well, I would include that in, too. I mean, the beautiful image of the early Christian community in Acts, where economic part of it is also stressed. If that becomes a model of community, I think it's there as a Pauline material, too. So, yeah, I would think so. Yeah. What's missing is some aggressive look to the world outside the Christian community. It's there in a few places, but not strongly.
I mean, that's
but
the
then you're dealing with the historical problem there. But the church at the beginning of this movement can't take on the world all at once. First has to shape itself.
You see, I'm not saying that, you know, you don't want to like the New Testament, but that's the book. I'm saying it makes it difficult for me to do a book.
Yeah, you're right. If we can't get it out of the New Testament, then we've lost
a
lot of our resources.
We have a major issue, and I think we do have a major issue. And sometimes I think, and this is my, I hope you don't take this the wrong way, sometimes we have to say we do things in spite of the New Testament. And that's more legitimate than trying to say I'm going to fit it in the New Testament, whether it's there or not.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes we just have to say we do it in spite of it. Because there is history, and it does live it. Including the figures in the New Testament and the people that chose what to keep in and what to keep out. And they have limitations. I mean, you know, it's difficult to go to New Testament, an Old Testament person, and ask them, what do you think about nuclear army? Because, I mean, it's difficult, not honest.
Does liberation theology really have a social ethic? In the sense that you're talking about.
My argument
in the sense of actually institution building.
My argument is that they don't. That they move too readily from theological assertions into political options, and they don't take advantage of the fullness of our ethical and political tradition in trying also to have an independent understanding of the values and principles that ought to guide social institutions. I mean, that's basically what I'm going to say tomorrow, but I already told you. They don't have it. And I see it as one of the things the Lutherans can contribute.
That's a big area.
And I think it's one of the things the Lutherans can contribute.
Yes. As an intern and a preacher now, I would like to know how pastors here have preached on Acts chapter 2, where the early Christian community held all things in common so that none would have need. Have you dealt with that, or what have you had to say about that from the pulpit?
Passing things.
Pardon?
Really, I think so we do. I think we say
that. I'm sorry.
It was like a passing fancy. It was something they did for a short time, but it didn't last long because it wasn't practical.
Noble experiment that failed. That has been a typical past interpretation, I hope.
I think so.
No, I think that, well, you have answered. I'm sure they read it differently now. I hope so. Yeah.
I think that there are two different ways how a person can deny the Bible. A person can say, I don't believe it. There are very few people who do that. And the second way to do it is not to do what the Bible says that you ought to do. Now, this is an example that we have already talked about many times in this meeting. Jesus says in one part in Luke, to all disciples, that if you wish to be my disciple, go and sell everything that you have and give the money to the poor and come and follow me. And the Acts chapter 2 is the similar kind of example. But these, of course, do not concern us anymore for some reason, because we don't do that. And we have to justify this obedience.
Let me be specific and say, what have you said about that from the pulpit?
I have said that I haven't sold everything that I possess and given the money to the poor, and I don't believe in this Bible in this manner. And people get very scared, but then they realize that, but that's exactly what they do.
How about somebody else?
Who has sold everything and
given to the poor? Your question implies a simplicity of answer, which I think people would be hesitant to give. Even the passage you quote. Is that a consistent application throughout the New Testament, that one, all Christian disciples must give all in order to follow Jesus? So you're into a question of biblical and hermeneutic, you know, interpretation. So there's no simple answer. Discipleship is never that simple. But if people haven't wrestled with that text as a disciple of Jesus Christ, then we're in trouble.
Yeah, but this is exactly the question that bothers me. Why do we wish to muddy the waters? I mean, if Jesus says, if you wish to be my disciple, go and do this. And we say, well, we have to interpret this. We have to see the context. And we have to somehow explain it away.
Well, the simple answer would be that there are other disciples in the Gospels of which that wasn't demanded. So you'd have to decide which context one passage would apply over against another. So the waters are muddied by Jesus himself.
So the New Testament is, are you saying that it's inconsistent?
I'm saying that it's a life diversity of options.
Yeah.
No, don't ask.
And to get back to my question, it was to hear the diversity of options, how they're dealt with.
Listen, let me put it this way to see if you get to my case. I think the most Lutheran tradition can claim is that it is a legitimate option within the Christian faith. You cannot argue it is the option within the Christian faith. And I think that happens with almost all the many other options we make. Maybe, yeah, listen, I make this political option. I think the most you can argue is I find that there is place for it within my Christian faith. You can never argue it is deduced from my Christian faith. And this is the option I give. And you're caught with that. Because there is diversity in the scripture. Certain people are asked to sacrifice a lot, and other people are left to be very generous and not sacrifice a lot. And you have them there. And I don't think it is as consistent. It's just a matter that there are different ways of doing it.
One more question. No, you better close.
Okay.
I appreciate the perspective you bring to North Americans, and that's the contrast is real helpful. Tutu, when he met with the North American Caucus at the World Council of Churches, expressed a real sense of feeling that I have tremendous compassion for you as North Americans, because I don't know how you could survive as Christians because the waters are so light. He said, for me in South Africa, to be a Christian is very clear. From your perspective, what hope is there for North Americans, or how do you see us as Christians surviving the muddy waters?
Well, you know, when you deal with a clear expression of sin like apartheid, certain things become simple. You know, the sense of good and evil become a little bit simple. When you don't have that internally within the country, well, then options are more ambiguous. I think the North American Christian community is the biggest community like Christian communities all over the world. It is difficult for North American Christians to get Christian identity of their faith because of the fluidity that exists between your political and economic life and your religious life. A lot of space to practice your faith. You appreciate that space. You can support you in here to do it on those things. But there is a sense in which it is somewhat easy to be Christian in this country. In the Soviet countries and the satellites, Christians have a clearer sense of identity of who they are, because they're pushed aside, they can't participate in that, they can't do that, they have to pay a price. You know, but it's unreasonable to expect the North American Christians to act like that. It's not there. Now, I have found tremendous amount of redeeming possibilities within the muddleness of it all. I'm persuaded that Nicaragua still exists, that Nicaragua, basically those Christians have really made a tremendous effort to contain forms of life, even though they have not been able to stop it. I think in other countries, I think you are becoming politically more suspicious, and the churches have played an important role in that, because it's a level of trust. You go someplace else and somebody tells you, I'm a Christian. It's a trust relationship. The differences, the disagreements and fights like we all have. I tend to be optimistic about the American Christian community. Sometimes a little bit impatient, but it's normal, I hope. of identity, very optimistic. I do worry of questions of identity. I do worry of questions of relevance, of faith. I do worry that sometimes you don't know the difference between your political options and your religious options. And you don't see conflicts with them sometimes. I worry about that. I do worry when the political administration begins to praise religious community, but the only reason they do it is because they're getting what they want out of it.